Welcome to It's All Politics from NPR News. I'm Ron Elving.
And I'm Ken Rudin.
And that's it for this week's political podcast.
No, Ron, there's a lot to talk about.
Oh, I felt it had been sort of a dull week.
No. History in the making this week.
This very week.
You know what happened?
Well,
for the first time in history.
For the very first time, an 84-year-old incumbent senator in New Jersey held off the challenge of
bigger than that. For the first time in history, a Rudin graduated high school.
That's really inspiring.
Yeah, thank you.
Could we move on now to our business at hand?
We can.
Barack Obama has clinched the Democratic nomination for president, and that made history, Ken.
That he would be the first person from Hawaii ever elected to the
presidency. The first person born in Hawaii.
Right, right.
The first African-American nominated by a major party in the United States. Incredible history made. Two candidates dividing the Democratic pledge delegates, 52% for an African-American, 48% for the first woman to get this close. It's been an extraordinary week.
We thought, everybody thought, Hillary Clinton certainly thought, that this would be over Super Tuesday in
February.
February 5th. This is the first week of June, and we only now can say for certainty that Barack Obama will be the Democratic nominee for president.
That's right, a historic juncture, and rightly enough, marked by some of the rhetoric Barack Obama used Tuesday night. Here's a little bit of what he had to say.
Because you chose to listen not to your doubts or your fears, but to your greatest hopes and highest aspirations, tonight we mark the end of one historic journey with the beginning of another. A journey that will bring a new and better day to America. Because of you, tonight I can stand here and say that I will be the Democratic nominee for the President of the United States of America.
And yet, with all the recognition and all of the note that was given to the historic significance of that moment, been watching the media this week? Heard about Barack Obama? Or have you heard about somebody else?
Well, the question everybody was saying is not so much how does Barack Obama reach 270. Of course, what you do is you take the beltway.
270
and then,
electoral
votes. Right, and then you get to 270, go to
as
Frederick.
Opposed to the freeway called
right. And but it's Hillary Clinton. What does she do? How does she react? Or what does she want? Remember, we used to ask that about Jesse Jackson.
She asked it herself.
What does Hillary want?
What does Hillary want? What does she want? Well, I want what I have always fought for in this whole campaign. I want to end the war in Iraq. I want to turn this economy around. I want health care for every American. I want every child to live up to his or her God-given potential. And I want the nearly 18 million Americans who voted for me to be respected, to be heard, and no longer to be invisible.
Ken, I want you to live up to your God-given potential.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I hereby resign the office of the presidency of the United States, effective Gerald Ford, my successor, will be sworn in this office on this date.
I'm glad to know that you're still channeling Richard Nixon at this late date. But what does Hillary want besides peace and freedom for all the peoples of the world?
She wants to take back her vote in 2002, voting to authorize the war in Iraq.
Oh, boy, does she ever.
Yes. She wants to be the Democratic nominee for president because, as she still says in this very week, that she would be the stronger candidate against John McCain in November, that she would have the votes. Somehow we all thought, perhaps, having gone over the top, Barack Obama going over the top, Hillary Clinton would have some kind of a concession on Tuesday.
But she still believes all these things.
She does.
She still believes she got more votes than Barack Obama, right. An arguable point, but let's say she believes it. She still looks at the polls and says, I'm stronger in Pennsylvania, I'm stronger in Ohio,
but
I'm stronger in Florida. And I think she is stronger in all the three states than Obama.
Right.
And those are the three states that, for the Clinton era in the 90s and today, are the states where the determination is made who will be the next president. Those are the swing states. So she says, hey, on the metrics that really matter, I'm the strongest. Why do we have to pay attention to this delegate count?
Because that is how one nominates a candidate for president.
But isn't it possible that these superdelegates can still turn around? There are 820 some of them. If they were to change their minds, a substantial number of them, neither candidate has a dispositive majority of the pledged delegates.
It's still possible that our listenership can be in double figures, but that's not going to happen either. Look, there's a lot of things that are possible. The point is that even since April 22nd, Pennsylvania primary, which Hillary Clinton won by 9 or 10 points, superdelegates were still going in her direction. Even, I mean, she had a very impressive run at the end with West Virginia, Kentucky, South Dakota, which I didn't think would happen.
But throughout all that time, March, April, May,
the superdelegates were going
the other way, 2 and 3 to 1.
And when Hillary Clinton at the end was talking about her popular vote lead, she was trying to make the case to these superdelegates that here's the reason to pick me. So it's kind of ironic that the people she thought would get her over the top, these superdelegates, many of whom endorsed her in 2007 when she was inevitable.
She was inevitable
she
in
was.
2007.
I thought she was.
And 2007 ended.
Yeah, and she was elected president in 2007.
She was not quite so inevitable in 2008.
No.
But what's with these superdelegates? How is it that as she turned it around in the second half of this contest, and she won again and again in the biggest states, and she did close the gap in popular vote and make it essentially a tie between the two, and given these metrics that do make sense about this big swing states, why on Tuesday did 50-some superdelegates go to Barack Obama and only one or two to Hillary
the whole day? I think there was a feeling that if Barack Obama was going to be the nominee, and Tim Russert and others told us a long time ago that Barack Obama will be the nominee, I think there are a lot of superdelegates, including Nancy Pelosi, Howard Dean, the chairman of the DNC, Harry Reid, and others, have said, look, this fight cannot go beyond Tuesday. Somebody has to win, somebody has to lose, and to go beyond June 4th will damage, irreparably perhaps, damage the party. The last thing they wanted was a fight over credentials, over rules, over delegates going into July, August, and into the convention in Denver.
That's right. Now, can we completely rule out the possibility of a credentials fight in Denver or of some kind of floor fight that would give some satisfaction to that remnant or that hardcore within the Clinton supporters that wants one?
Well, it would be very interesting to hear what Hillary Clinton has to say on Saturday when she does her somewhat of a swan song, we think. We don't know what exactly she'll say. Certainly she will congratulate Barack Obama, and I think she will acknowledge that he has the delegates to win the Democratic nomination. But she could still fight for, like, full voting rights for the delegates of Florida and Michigan. I mean, that could be a credentials fight that she may want to go.
But look, it's going to be a surrogate struggle. It's going to be something that all these credentialed media people who are going to Denver in August can cover. Otherwise, it's just going to turn into another dull, conventional convention, which we all know doesn't really produce news. But if there are hundreds of us there looking for something that looks like a story, even the slightest little wrinkle, like a credentials fight that doesn't seem to affect the nomination, is going to get enormous coverage. And it's going to be another demonstration of how Hillary Clinton's people don't want to go over to Obama. It's going to be another demonstration of his weakness as the nominee.
Now, we saw last Saturday at the DNC Rules and Bylaws Committee that there was a lot of raw emotion coming out of it from disappointed Clinton supporters, not simply because Michigan and Florida didn't go their way. They felt that the deck was stacked against them, and they feel that it was never a fair fight. Of course, a lot of them said clearly that it was because she was a woman.
What fight are we talking about now? Are we talking about the Michigan delegation seated at the convention, or are we talking about the overall 2008?
Michigan and Florida was symbolic of what was
symbolic grace note on top of a long contest that a lot of Clinton supporters felt had been in some sense or another prejudiced against her as a woman. Ken, what about the media?
I think the question about media coverage of this is fair, and I think it deserves another look about whether Barack Obama or Hillary Clinton, who got more favorable coverage. Having said that, Hillary Clinton didn't lose the nomination because of media coverage. She lost it because she was outworked, especially in the caucuses in February.
Out-organized. Well, they didn't go to a lot of these.
And which is so ironic, as we pointed out so many times, Harold Ickes basically was responsible for this kind of system that meant that these caucus states would matter so much.
Little parenthetical explanation here. Harold Ickes, who's now, of course, the strategist for the Hillary Clinton campaign, has been an active element in putting together these rules
decades ago,
going back to 1972.
Right.
So he knows all of this. He understands it all. But at a point in the campaign, much earlier, when he was not really running the show, when Mark Penn was running the show, the caucuses were not fully respected. And the Clinton campaign did not really go after those little states. Perfect example, Barack Obama wound up getting more delegates net out of Idaho than Hillary Clinton got net winning the state of Ohio. This makes no sense. But it was as much the fault of the Clinton campaign for not contesting these little places.
Because it was over on February 5th.
Of course, they weren't going to count.
Right.
If you're going to win New York and California and Florida,
New Jersey,
would you worry about Idaho? Well, now they know why. But there were other things, too, and I would go all the way back to 2002, as you said a moment ago, and wanting to change that vote, as I'm sure Hillary Clinton has wanted to change her vote on Iraq many times. Had she not cast that vote in favor of use of force in Iraq and giving George W. Bush a blank check, I wonder if Barack Obama would have even run against her.
Well,
I don't think he would have seen an opening. I don't think he would have seen any chance to get traction. So there were many contributing factors to the frustration of the Clinton candidacy,
Bill Clinton, as we all know, the 1990s, his two terms as president, most popular Democrat on the face of the earth until this campaign, and it became about Bill Clinton getting back to the power, the finger-wagging, the lecturing, which began in South Carolina, his ill-timed and ill-advised, I think, remark that, well, so what if Barack Obama wins South Carolina? Jesse Jackson won it, too.
He was trying to say that Barack Obama's winning a state really big didn't necessarily have a lot of implication for a lot of later states. That's also another interpretation of what Bill Clinton said. Now, it came across at the time very badly, and I think he realized it almost immediately.
I disagree.
But he's been denying it ever since.
Yeah, I disagree. I think there was a concerted effort to not allow Barack Obama to transcend race, and that's why you had comments by Bob Kerry, by Bob Johnson,
Barack Hussein Obama,
Billy Shaheen, mm-hmm. All those Clinton surrogates who would either remind you about Barack Obama's middle name or his drug use of the past.
All
his
happened
race.
In about the same week to 10 days.
Right.
And just about the time that they had lost Iowa and were very worried about New Hampshire, and then, of course, worried about some of the other January primaries.
Which leads to the question is, why would Barack Obama pick Hillary Clinton to be his vice president?
Because he would think that was the only way to gain peace in the party, which right now seems to elude him, and also perhaps a way to increase his appeal in Ohio and Pennsylvania and Florida. But here again, history tells us, if we can count on history for anything, that vice presidents don't really help your appeal in any state other than their own. Lyndon Johnson gets you Texas in 1960, but he doesn't get you Oklahoma. He doesn't get you states where you don't already have standing of your own.
Well, plus the fact that, Geraldine Ferraro did not get Walter Mondale in New York. Jack Kemp didn't get Bob Dole in New York. And it's not only that, it's also what adds to the ticket. And I think there'd be more conflicts and more tension with an Obama-Clinton so-called dream ticket than there would be with Obama picking somebody more. I mean, look, he wants to have a major announcement. It was going to be a great moment when he names a running mate. But there has to be another choice other than Hillary Clinton. And I think there's tremendous pressure on him from the disgruntled Clintonistas who say, look, the only way this party can unite in November is with her on the ticket.
So it has to be somebody who's acceptable to those people. Because I think even some of the people who are Clinton supporters can see the difficulty of having not just an Obama-Clinton ticket, but an Obama-Clinton-Clinton ticket.
Right. Chelsea.
And the idea of having three people trying to run the White House, and certainly Hillary Clinton is not going to defer to President Obama in the traditional fashion in which vice presidents must do. So that is a big problem. I think that's what makes it almost impossible for him to put her on the ticket. And if it is the only way that you can bring back her supporters, the only way you can contest some of these swing states, he might just be out of luck.
Okay, we can go into the list of VP hopefuls and another podcast, assuming there will be another podcast. But what's next for the general election? Now it's McCain and Obama.
It's a McCain and Obama, and John McCain chose to come out on Tuesday night and try to contest the Democrats' dominance of the air and the news that night. Probably.
Wait, remind me again, John McCain?
Yes, John McCain is the Republican presumptive nominee who won the primaries and pretty much has dominated, pretty much had it wrapped up in early March.
Wow.
In fact, you could even say on Super Tuesday he was clearly going to be the winner.
So he has united the Republican Party behind him, yes?
Yes and no. There are still those who think he should be emphasizing his appeal to conservatives within the party. People like Karl Rove are advising him to harden the base. And then you have other people saying, no, this is not a good year to be a Republican. The brand is down. George W. Bush is not popular. He's under 30% approval. So this is the worst possible year to be telling people you're a Republican. Appeal to the center. Reach out for disgruntled Democrats. Go after the Clinton
women.
Supporters
women.
Who are disillusioned by her loss.
Could he do both? I mean, I think he has to do both. He has to unite the party. He has to get conservatives behind him, because there is a conservative option with Bob Barr and the Libertarian Party. I think we're overstating Bob Barr's appeal as a third-party candidate.
It would be a gesture of a vote.
But I think he has to do both as well. I mean, the appeal he showed in 2000 and in many primaries with independent support, he needs that, obviously. If there's disillusionment, disagreement, disenchantment in the Democratic ranks, he's got to take advantage of it. Or if he runs as a big R, capital R Republican, he's finished.
So this is a good year to try to break out of the regular red-blue paradigm. And one way to do that has been proposed by a number of reformers and embraced to some degree by some of the people in the McCain campaign. And that would be to have a series of town hall meetings around the country featuring the two candidates as an alternative to the traditional kind of media-driven debates that have become so important in past presidential elections. And then David Plouffe, who is the campaign manager for Barack Obama, put a little spin on that and said, okay, let's have town hall meetings. But instead of that kind of question and answer format, let's have traditional Lincoln-Douglas style debates. What do you think of that, Ken?
Well, which one would be Lincoln and which one would be Douglas?
Well, I think it's pretty obvious which one Barack Obama would like to be associated with.
Buster Douglas?
Do you know how a Lincoln-Douglas debate is structured?
Well, it would be in 1858. And there would be no TV.
First speaker speaks for an hour, second speaker speaks for 90 minutes, and then the first speaker comes back for another 30 minutes. Still with me, Ken? Are
yes,
you still awake?
But if Joe Biden were the Democratic nominee, that would be great.
That would be ideal. That would be pretty much Joe's idea of an opening statement.
Only get him for an hour.
Well, you know, but I mean, really, one speaks for an hour, the other speaks for 90 minutes. It'd be a lot like this podcast.
You know, we're talking, we have plenty of time to talk about what's going to happen in the fall with the Senate races, and obviously McCain versus Obama will be a lot of...
We'll be there. We'll come back.
But this is also...
Big
this,
anniversary. Today.
This week is the 40th anniversary of Bobby Kennedy's assassination. And, you know, for all the comparisons to Barack Obama, as far as the leadership, the new politics and all that, I just think that when we think of Bobby Kennedy, it's not so much what he accomplished, because he was shot down before he was even nominated, and he probably may not have even been nominated.
Probably not.
But he represented a new politics, a hope, young people, blacks, Latinos. He tried to put together this coalition in a very ugly year, 1968. And when he announced for the presidency in March of 68, it was a very dramatic moment. A lot of people thought he was ruthless. A lot of people thought he was taking advantage of Gene McCarthy's good showing in the New Hampshire primary. There was a lot of critics of Bobby Kennedy then and today. Ted Sorensen on our air said he hated Bobby Kennedy
at the time,
in the 1950s. In the 1950s when he...
Oh, when he worked for
Joe McCarthy.
Joseph McCarthy.
But, you know, there's something... But when I think of Bobby Kennedy, not so much about June 6, 1968, but I think of him more in March of 68 when he surprised everybody, you know, after the New Hampshire primary and announced his candidacy for president.
I do not run for the presidency merely to oppose any man, but to propose new policies. I run because I am convinced that this country is on a perilous course, and because I have such strong feelings about what must be done. And I feel that I'm obliged to do all that I can.
That was Robert F. Kennedy announcing his candidacy for the presidency in March of 1968. This week we marked the 40th anniversary of his assassination. And that's it for this week's political podcast.
You can follow NPR's political coverage at npr.org/elections.
I'm Ron Elving.
And I'm Ken Rudin.
Join us again next week for It's All Politics from NPR.
I run for the presidency because I want the Democratic Party and the United States of America to stand for hope instead of despair, for reconciliation of men instead of the growing risk of world war. I run because it is now unmistakably clear that we can change these disastrous, divisive policies only by changing the men who are now making them. But the reality of recent events in Vietnam...